To talk with Art Bell in the Kingdom of Nye from east of the Rockies, dial 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, including Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. Now again, here's Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. Welcome, everybody. If you're just joining us at this hour, boy, did you miss some interview with Dr. Malin, the man in charge of the Mars photography that we all hope is going to go on. It was a very well done interview. Lasted about 20-25 minutes, somewhere in there. Linda Moulton Howe did it with Michael Malin. And I came away with a lot of impressions, some of them rather cynical, but maybe that's just me. We've come the whole way this week now with regard to this controversy, beginning with Richard Hoagland, and then, of course, the two scientists we had on last night, Dr. McDaniel, and then Michael Malin tonight. So we've heard from just about everybody. And we will do kind of an assessment of the whole thing as we move forward, I'm sure, this morning in our conversation with Greg Braden. And this is a program I have been looking forward to doing for a while. I think you'll enjoy it. First, I again would like to note the sad passing of actor J.T. Walsh. J.T. was most recently on Dark Skies on NBC, and I was fortunate enough to have done a scene with him, spent a couple of hours or more with him. A really, really nice guy. And of course, he did a lot more than Dark Skies. He did A Few Good Men, Sling Blade, The Grifters, which was a fabulous movie, Good Morning Vietnam, and on and on. He's got a long list. Came to acting late in life, and has passed on a heart attack at 54, J.T. Walsh. Very sad. Now, again, I am going to have continuing comments for you on this Mars Global Explorer story, and it, believe me, does not stop here. Not by a long shot. So you'll be hearing more about this next week, but I thought the interview with Dr. Michael Malin was particularly revealing and interesting. And I'll use those words. It was certainly professionally done, but I speak now of the content of Dr. Malin's interview. I just thought it was a bit of a dance, and I would love to, Dr. Malin, if you're out there, I would very much like to interview you personally, and if you can find the time, I can find the time, and I'll leave it at that. Maybe some of you kind people out there would fire some email at Dr. Malin and let him know that I would be very interested in interviewing him personally. Now, scientist, author, and guide to sacred sites throughout the world, Greg Braden has been featured on television and radio programs nationwide. He has two books that I know many of you know about, one called Awakening to Zero Point and Walking Between the Worlds. They've received wide acclaim as definitive texts marrying ancient traditions, modern science, religion, and spirituality into a unified view of daily life. Professional careers as a geologist and aerospace engineer provide Greg with the unique ability to guide us through our ancient science of inner technology, offering an original wisdom, moving us beyond the challenges of earth changes, health, and relationship into the greatest possibilities of human experience. Here is, from Florida, Greg Braden. Greg, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Art. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
I'm very happy to have you. With your background, perhaps you would take a moment. You were, after all, an aerospace engineer. I take it you have followed the Mars story and the Cydonia story and the face and the controversy and all the rest of it.
Well, I have, Art. Actually, I 1990, I left the corporation that actually built the probes that are doing the photography. They Martin Marietta Aerospace had built the Viking probes back in the 70s.
Right.
In 76, and are playing a key role in this most recent mission. And what I have to confess is, from my location, I was unable to find this last hour's interview. So I'm kind of curious now, just from listening to you, what was the gist of the interview? What was happening with this latest?
Well, Dr. Malin indicated that it would be for him a high point in his career. Were he able to image Cydonia and prove, for example, that the phase on Mars is not a natural thing, and that he would, boy, get it out automatically like this. He said, in my opinion, it's going to be about 1 in 50 million that it's not natural. And he said that would be like hitting the $50 million lottery. Now, when you listen to other scientists, Greg, they come up with numbers almost as strong on the other side, indicating that the work they have done, very extensive with what we have, indicates there's very little chance that these objects are natural at all.
Oh, how interesting.
So I noted that. And then, of course, he said, we may not be able to image it at all. There are no guarantees, in which case I just have to say I'm sorry.
Mm.
Now, my comment to Linda, and my comment again tonight, is that examine the lives of most people who win $50 million in the lottery, since that was his analogy. It ruins their lives, generally. They blow the money. They get into drugs, or they start drinking, or they, in some way or another, are not prepared for it. Now, I happen to be a believer in the Brookings study. You know about that.
And I'm familiar with that, yes.
Yes. And I think that it is as operative today as it was the day it was written. I don't think very much about society has really changed, other than a few good E.T. movies and Independence Day and that kind of thing. I think there would be great disruption to religious institutions, scientific institutions, and you're free to disagree with me totally on this, Greg.
Well, Art, this is, once again, synchronicity chimes in, and as I was thinking about how we may lead in to our discussions tonight, this couldn't have been a more opportunity or a more opportune way to do this, because the discussion we're going into now, I thought we might have on the last of our 4 hours, and why not start right there and then just move forward?
Sure.
I believe this is an example of a question that I ask. I actually just wrote an entire article about this in our most recent newsletter.
Okay.
And the question I posed is this. It's a more general question. Why is it that the discoveries that hold the greatest potential for bringing peace into our world are being delayed? And I believe the face on Mars is one of those, certainly the opening of the chambers under the Sphinx, the newly discovered chambers in the Great Pyramid, and the excavation of what appear to be archaeological sites under the ice in Antarctica. And the bottom line for all of those, Art, is if any one of those were to come to fruition publicly,
then we've got a Brookings problem.
Well, what would happen is we would never see ourselves the same again. And moment,
right.
And again, from previous interviews, you may recall, or listeners may recall, I'm an optimist.
Do you think, I know you are, but do you think it one of these discoveries, let's pick one, I don't care. Let's go to Egypt and talk about Giza, and let's say that they somehow get authorized to dig under the left paw of the Sphinx, and they find, oh my God, the Hall of Records.
Right.
Which indicates that we are not by far the first civilization on the planet, that they have come and gone, and the Hall of Records is thought by many, Greg, and check me if I'm wrong, to be kind of a last will and testament of a civilization for some future civilization.
Right.
That's
accurate. There are subtext that suggests that there are many halls of records, and that the particular one under the Sphinx may contain a continuous record of human history for the last 50,000 years or so prior to its closing around the Ice Age about 10,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So if, and that's a perfect example, if that were done in front of live public scrutiny, you know, covered by CNN and the Fox networks, which are proposing to do just that.
Oh, yes.
In that moment, humanity never can look at itself the same again. All of a sudden, we're not Egyptians and Americans and blacks and whites and Native Americans. All of a sudden, we're human with a collective history, and if we're to believe what the text suggests, we're on a collective path toward a great turning point is apparently very close at hand, and we'll lead into that for the rest of the evening.
Oh, I believe that.
Well, and the reason I believe, and this is the question I pose, why is it that these discoveries with potential, the greatest potential for peace, are being delayed? My question is, are we really ready? Are we really ready to redefine our history? Are we really ready?
I'm more interested in your answer.
What I believe, I'm seeing both sides of the story, and what I'm seeing is there are many more people that are ready, and a handful of people, it appears, that are reluctant. And even in the power structures, I'm seeing a lot of disagreement within the power structures in the past that have said, we're not ready, and now there are some that say, well, maybe this is the time, if we're ever going to do it, maybe.
Let's give you an example of why I feel the way I do, and I want you to jump in, and you just jump all over me anytime you want to, all right? I get mail by bins. I get bins of mail at a time. Every time we go to the post office, we have bins of mail, thousands and thousands of letters.
Mm.
And about 20% of those letters, Greg, are from devout Christians.
All right.
Who think that I'm damn near the devil incarnate, or that I am, and that because I discuss the things that I discuss, the possibilities, for example, that you and I are talking about right now,
right,
that I'm going to go straight to hell without passing go, that I'm deceived, and that I'm working for the devil. 20%, Greg, 20%.
And
now,
what's the reason that they would give for that?
Well, Greg, the discovery that we just talked about as an example in Egypt.
In Egypt.
What do you think that would do to those who take the word of the Bible literally?
Well, this is, again, Art, this is a perfect lead-in for what we're doing tonight. Because because what happened, and this is the key, and why I've really put a lot of thought into the way we can approach this tonight. 1,700 years ago, Art, key elements of our most sacred texts were taken out of the open literature, and the technology, the belief systems, the history, the science that we have developed since that time are based, at very best, they're based in incomplete understandings of our relationship with our world and with one another.
All right, 1,700 years ago, right?
1,700 years ago.
Right, why do you think 1,700 years ago they got real revisionist? Why do you think that?
I've gone back and forth. I've looked at the text to see exactly why. This was in the year 325 A.D., during the time of Constantine.
Yes.
We know of at least 25 of what today we would call biblical texts, and at least 20 supporting texts. And this is where it gets really important. They weren't necessarily biblical texts. They were supporting technical documents that were removed in the year 325 A.D., and the texts that were left were rearranged. 700 years later, they were translated to the languages of the West, poorly translated, even further confusing our relationship with our world, our heritage, and between one another.
But, Greg, would you agree there was absolutely intentional revisionist action?
If I'm to believe the historical text, Art, that's what it says. And
you have to believe it was intentional, right?
Well, if I'm to believe the text, and what I know, Art, is that seldom do we know the whole story. And if I'm to believe the text the way they read now, I'd have to say yes. And there was probably more to it that we haven't really had.
Then I would have to say, okay, fine. Why?
Well, why?
Why revise history at about 1,700 years? Why?
You know, I don't know why that particular date. I don't know.
No, I'm not asking that. Why do it at all? What's the motivation?
Well, the intent, in the open literature, the intent was that there were redundant texts, they were confusing, they were mysterious, they didn't make sense to the common people, and that's exactly what we're seeing today, as people believing that they can interpret our experience of life for us. So 1,700 years ago, they were saying, you know, the average man really isn't capable of understanding this kind of material, let's make it simple for him. We're kind of seeing that same thing again today. And one of the places where, on the one hand, this happened, on the other hand, it may not make that much difference now, because those texts were also the basis for what later became the Dead Sea Scrolls. They were the basis for the Nag Hammadi libraries,
mm-hmm.
the great libraries in Lhasa. By the way, we're going there in April, and next time we do a show, I hope to have some new information directly from those libraries to share with you, because the information was so key. It wasn't relegated to a single text, Art. It was very well known before 1,700 years ago. So at the very best, and this is what leads us right into our discussion tonight, at the very best, our view of our world today, our science, our technology,
mm-hmm.
Our history is based in incomplete information. So what I'd say to people who are adamant about looking at the text, I agree 100%, go back pre-1700 years ago and look at the original texts. And
incomplete, Greg, how about willfully incorrect? Would you go for that?
In some cases, that may be. And to be honest, I'm less concerned with that now.
Well, the reason I'm harping on that is because I think I know the reason why everything was revised when you suggest it was.
Why do you say that?
Well, I say that because I think that what we've been discussing tonight, for example, a discovery in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
would be as disruptive to society as the truth would have been continuing way back when.
Oh, I agree.
You do?
To society as we know it today.
Yes, sir.
So a key portion, Art, and this is where I believe so much of the discussion about this time in history is being overlooked. A key portion of these texts was regarding what today we might call an inner technology. It's the technology it's the technology to intentionally change body chemistry, to intentionally change genetic ordering, intentionally shift immunity within our bodies.
These things, yes, I know. But these imply a very technologically advanced ancient civilization.
Oh, precisely. So what's happening, Art, is we're witnessing all of these changes. And
just one more thing, Greg.
Sure.
Maybe even a civilization that could put a monument on Mars.
Precisely. And if we're to believe the text, that's precisely what happened. And we can come back to that. What I'd like to do is lay out for the listeners where I'd like to go, and then let's jump back in.
All right, we will do that. We're getting close to the bottom of the hour. Percentage-wise, do you know how many people it took to start the American Revolution?
Do I know?
Uh-huh.
I know it took just a handful.
Nowhere near 20%, Greg.
No.
Nowhere near 20%. All right, hold on. We'll be back to you. I know I'm kind of hung up on that, but I'm so in touch with all of you out there, and 80% of you I know are going to say, baloney, I'm ready. Man, I can handle it. Give me an ancient civilization. Let me know that I was genetically constructed from somebody else. I don't have a problem with that. 80% of you. But fully, 20% of you couldn't even begin to handle it. I rest my case. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Now, From the Kingdom of Nye, more Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Here again is Art.
Back now to scientist and author Greg Braden. Welcome back, Greg.
It's a pleasure to be back. Art, I have to say that was the fastest 20 minutes of discussion I think we've had in a long time. It went by very quickly.
Yes. I think it's at the very root of everything else that we talk about. I mean, we can discuss the evidence for past civilizations, and I think there's damn good evidence. We can discuss the fact that they may have left artifacts on the moon, that might have had space travel, might have had genetic altering capabilities. We could discuss the possibility of extraterrestrial visitors who have tampered with our genetics or may even be our creators for all we know. But whatever we're talking about, the Hall of Records, you name it, it all comes down to the same thing. Is society prepared to accept this knowledge without toppling?
Art, this is exactly the place. I thought we might end up here in about 4 hours in our discussion. And so we're beginning here. Who knows where we'll go. I believe this is the opportunity of discussions like this and of a program like yours. And I agree with you. I believe there are more people who are ready to embrace the possibility of a heritage much greater than we've ever been led to believe, relatively few people who believe we're not ready for it, and those few, in many instances, are the ones who are dictating the policies that are preventing us from accessing that heritage. And I believe, and I've seen this in my own program, this is the 12th year now that I've offered these programs in one form or another. They watch the programs. They listen to shows like this.
I'm sure.
And I believe if we develop this information responsibly and say, yes, maybe that information was taken from us 1,700 years ago, maybe it wasn't. I think it's how we go about embracing it and implementing it into our lives today that determines how quickly it is actually acknowledged and made public. And
This is good. You're going to be the optimist. I'm going to be the pessimist. I'm going to, for example, say now, Greg, I'm even willing to entertain the notion that there is a cabal of some sort, generally separate from our elected representative government, that is preventing this information from coming forth.
Okay.
In other words, I don't think, for example, the Clinton administration would prevent this kind of information.
No,
but I think this has been controlled by a group of people or organizations for a long time. I'm starting to sound like Richard Hoagland. But I really think that I can embrace that possibility.
Well, it ties back into what we were talking about earlier. 1,700 years ago, when this information was taken out of our general text, it was relegated to secret societies, mystery schools, priesthoods that have evolved over time. I'm saying now, Art, is that you and me and our listeners in this generation, we have a choice now because we have the opportunity to rise above what that means and find a more positive way to acknowledge it, say, okay, it happened 1,700 years ago. This is now. Let's bring this wisdom into our lives now. Let's integrate it into our societies responsibly, into our technologies, and let's take humanity to places that we've only dreamed of in conscious memory because we've already been angry. We've already chastised those who have kept this from us before. I think we have the choice now to move in a new direction and to do this a new way. And again, maybe that's just the optimist in me. I've seen this happen before in smaller groups.
I am going to be going on a cruise in May with Dr. Zahi Hawass, who is the Antiquities Director at Giza, and Graham Hancock, Robert Bavall, Daniel Brinkley, and I'm going to be moderating a debate between these gentlemen. Every prospect, some one of them, or even me, may be going into the sea. That was a comment made, by the way, by Dr. Hawass.
It's cold water up there, all right?
It's cold water indeed. Now, I will have an opportunity to ask Dr. Hawass any and all questions I wish to. If you had that opportunity, Greg,
yes,
what would you ask him?
I would probably ask him the same thing that you are going to ask him. I would ask if that chamber has been opened in recent history.
Answer no.
Yes or no?
No, the answer is no.
That's my understanding. The answer is no. I was just quoted on the World Wide Web as having said yes, and we had been in there. And
really?
That was just a couple of weeks ago.
Was that an accurate quote?
It was not accurate. We were just there. We came home in December, and to the best of my knowledge, when we left, it had not been opened, although I believe we're very close.
I am answering as Zahi would. I didn't say that was necessarily what I believed. Zahi would say no. And then I asked him another question. I've got it on videotape when I was there.
Uh-huh.
I said, Dr. Hawass, what evidence is there that at one time this may have been Atlantis? And his answer, in good, strong, Egyptian-accented voice, was, "Art, never one drop of sand has ever indicated Atlantis was anywhere near here."
You know, Art, this ties back to the first question you asked me when we came on almost an hour ago. If we were to confirm this face on Mars, which by some estimates is being dated at over 50,000 years old, which incidentally is the same age that the Hall of Records, the continuous record of human history, over 50,000 years, or if...
By the way, how do we know that? How do we know it's that old?
We don't know for sure. This is what some of the records, as we go back and look at the dates and the records of Herodotus and Greek historians, and we piece the dates together, these are the kinds of dates that we're coming up with, and it's all circumstantial evidence for right now.
Mm.
New Earth imaging radar is showing vast archaeological sites, what look to be vast, vast archaeological sites, underneath several miles of ice in Antarctica. And again, my question is if...
There would be another one that would do it, by the way.
Well, if we're really serious about understanding our history, why are these kinds of discoveries being delayed? My belief is that we're still preparing, and I had this very discussion with Graham Hancock, Robert Bouval, John West. We met in Boulder, Colorado twice in 1997 in private meetings. And what I shared with them is it's the perspective I'd like to bring to this discussion this evening. If these cultures and if these technologies were indeed here 50,000 years ago, we know, for example, that Australian Aboriginal DNA can be traced back at least 35,000 years directly. So we know we were here at least 35,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good chance, Art, that these societies and the sciences were based on a very different technology than the path that we have chosen today. And my offering to Bouval and Hancock and West was that we may even accelerate the process of understanding what's in these chambers if we understand this technology, and that it's a technology we're just now beginning to suspect. Our own science is documenting this inner technology today, and we'll get into that for the rest of the evening.
Dr. Hovind, do you know the name Dr. Hovind?
I do not. I'm not familiar with that name.
He is a creationist.
Hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I think they're going to repeat that program this weekend. We have new policy, folks, of repeating older programs now, so it'll be like 7 days a week of new shows. Anyway, I think he'll be on this weekend, I think. And you know what he thinks, Greg?
No, I'm not familiar with his work.
He thinks that we are 6,000 years old, not a year older. 6,000 years.
This is a synchronicity again, Art. I was just going to say those exact words because you asked the implications. There are some belief systems that believe Earth is exactly 6,000 years old.
Right.
And then we look at the Aboriginal oral traditions that go back many thousands of years. We look at their DNA that goes back 35,000 years. We look at the implications in our own history. I mean, we believe that we're pretty liberal here in the West in some respects. And we look at what happened with John West and Robert Schock trying to date the Sphinx at only 8,000 years old. And we're talking about now dating that pre-Ice Age. The implications, I believe this is the generation where all this changes. This is the generation where we are living the past paradigm, and we're developing a new one, and that's happening in the presence of one another in this generation. Next generation, it'll be a little easier because the new ideas now have been offered. This is the generation. I think history will look back at this generation, Art, and they're going to say this is where the choices were made to embrace the inner technology rather than giving our power away to the machines that we've built. This is the generation that chose to really embrace the history and the heritage that we have behind us and carry it forward.
Greg, what social signs could you point to for me to substantiate that this generation is going to be the one?
I'm looking at what I look at are patterns of energy, and we can look at those many different ways.
Patterns of energy.
Almost universally, ancient texts, traditions, calendars point to this time in history as being unique in terms of Earth and human experience.
I think something's going to happen.
Sure, they point to all kinds of changes that we can expect. I'm looking at social changes, political changes, economic changes. I'm looking at the very obvious things, the breaking down of communist ideals, the way that families are restructuring the family units globally, not just in the West. I'm looking at how many new ideas, new kinds of ideas we've had to embrace to bring us to the point where we are right now. And for me, that's very exciting. What I see is a relatively small handful of people who are holding on to the old ideas that were not ready, and they're watching really carefully, Art, to see how people embrace the new ideas. Let me give you an example.
Greg, this is the same handful of people that burned witches at the stake.
It very well could be, Art. It very well could be.
It is. Oh, it is.
In the mid-70s, I was working in the oil and gas industry as a geologist, and I was also working as an engineer on the side developing free energy devices with some other researchers you may have even had on your show.
Now, there's an interesting combination. You worked as a geologist looking for oil and stuff and worked on free energy at the same time?
At the same time. In the 90s, I worked in the defense.
Yeah, I'm surprised you weren't burned at the stake.
Well, you know, in the 90s, I worked for the Defense Department working on the MX missile, and at the same time was developing programs based in the ancient sciences of compassion.
You worked on the MX?
I worked on the Peacekeeper missile from 85 until 90. Was my
I'm curious, Greg. We're going to get off to the side here, but
sure.
I can't help but ask. I've never talked to anybody who did that. What sort of mental processes does one experience as you work on a world-ending weapon?
Well, Art, the first thing I ask myself is, why me? Of all people, with my background, my beliefs, my understandings in peace and compassion,
yes.
Why did I find myself in that project? And I think that's exactly why, because I had such a charge on such a judgment about that kind of technology. I had just read a book by Carl Sagan called The Cold and the Dark.
Yes.
Which was a modeling of scenarios between the U.S. and the Soviets in the event of the nuclear war. And when I hired on with in the aerospace industry, I believed I was going to work on space programs. And what happens, Art, if you've ever worked around these before, they hire you, and then you wait 4, 5, or 6 months for your clearance before you ever know what project you're assigned to.
Well, you did work on a space program. It's just that your craft came down pretty quick.
No, I worked on others. I worked on the Magellan probes.
I understand.
Space shuttle.
That was a joke.
I know it was. I should have taken a minute to to laugh. It was a really very difficult time in my life. And when my assignment came down, you know, I thought I'd be on the space shuttle or something like that. And they said, well, you'll write software in support of the Peacekeeper.
Yeah,
I thought Peacekeeper. You know, that sounds great. What's that? And they said, well, it's what we call the MX missile. And I thought, my God.
Nuclear winter generator.
And I had to work through that. I had many sleepless nights.
That's what I was asking.
Sure, many sleepless nights. My wife at that time would see me wake up in bed sweating at night because I said, why in the world am I doing this? And what I came to understand, and many listeners already know this, the technology in and of itself isn't good or bad. It's how it's applied. And at that time, Art, I'm not saying that...
Wait a minute now. Does that statement really apply to the MX? In other words, I can't think of any more negative side of nuclear technology than we could discuss than the MX or the SS-18 or 20 or whatever, you know, on the other side or whatever.
Well,
nuclear missiles that, if used, would... Well, you tell me.
Well,
if there had been a full exchange, Greg, what would have occurred? Or if there could still be one, for that matter. I think it's very dangerous.
What I'll say, Art, is, as in many cases, seldom do we have all the information when we're having these conversations. And what has just come out, and this was actually part of discussion I thought we'd get into later tonight, the reason that so many Eastern Bloc countries were so ready to let go of the nuclear arsenal was because they had something even better that today we call biological weapons. There was a Dateline, just did a special on it two nights ago.
Yeah.
And it was, for whatever reason, it's the path that we chose, Art. We did have relative peace and stability during the 20 or so years that we were doing this, and the choices were made then to back down on all sides. And that's precisely what happened. What we didn't hear is that there are other things in the wings.
But at the time that you were doing that work, you didn't know any of this.
We did. Actually, at the time we were doing the work, we knew that. And it was a very personal thing for me. I thought about leaving.
You knew that the communist bloc was going to break up then?
Oh, no, not that. Certainly not that.
See, that's what I mean. In other words, at the time that you did the work,
right,
the possibility was still thought to be strong that we could have a nuclear war.
We knew that there were other weapon systems that were being developed based on electromagnetics and based on bacteriological weaponry.
Well, that's a whole separate discussion.
It is, and that these very quickly would be moved into obsolescence. We knew that even before the program was finished. We knew that. But it didn't make any difference for me. I was still, writing software to support that. And for whatever reason, that's the path that our consciousness chose. Mm-hmm. That path was a relatively stable path during that time. It held that stability until the time when both sides would back down during the Reagan administration.
I am not in any way criticizing, and I think Ronald Reagan forced the end of communism. I thought that for a long time, and the MX was one of the things that did the trick. So I'm not criticizing that in any way. I was just sort of vaguely curious about the mental process you went through working on such a weapon.
Well, I appreciate your sensitivity to that. It's a question that I'm seldom asked, and it was actually a really very challenging time in my life. Especially because of my belief systems, and again, I think we find ourselves in those positions, and we have a really strong judgment regarding something. We often find ourselves in the presence of that, just so we can come to terms with what that judgment is all about.
Did you get close to quitting?
Pardon me?
Did you get close to quitting?
Not quitting, reassigning, and again, my focus was always more on the space program than defense, and the two were very closely related.
And are today.
At that time, well, they were, and they were good companies. We did a good job, and the program was almost obsolete before it ever completed because new technologies were being SDI was coming in. We were also part of the SDI platforms that were being developed, Star Wars Defense Initiative, at that time, which is a whole different discussion.
It is, and I would simply ask you, if we were attacked, if there was a full-scale attack from Russia, for example, do we have enough of SDI in place to shoot down the missiles?
You know, Art, no one really openly has ever said that we ever deployed SDI.
I know.
What I know is that when we tested them,
yes,
they went up on the shuttles for testing, and once they were testing, many of them were left in place. And to what extent and how much, some of the programs were never developed, others were developed to greater or lesser extents. and I really believe, and the reason I kind of hedge on that is because I believe that SDI was never implemented for that purpose. I think it was for something much different than that.
And that, too, is another discussion, and maybe we'll have it. We're at the top of the hour. I'm Art Bell. Greg Braden is my guest, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM.
From the Kingdom of Nye, Coast to Coast AM continues with Art Bell.
Once again, here's Greg Braden. Greg?
I'm here.
All right. I guess we're going to backtrack a little bit. And regardless of... And by the way, I want to say one more thing. Having said everything I said last hour to you, I am still in favor, regardless of what I think the consequences are going to be, of plowing ahead and learning the truth, no matter what the truth may turn out to be.
As am I, Art, and what I wanted to do just before the top of the hour, we'd started a conversation and we digressed just a little bit, and I wanted just to have some completion with that before we go on.
Let us do that.
The example I had two examples when I was working in oil and gas and also developing free energy.
Yes.
Techniques on the side. What we discovered, and I believe this applies to this plowing ahead with the truth of our heritage and our history.
Yes.
Is that when we took those free energy, proven, demonstrable, tangible,
real
technologies, we working prototypes, and we took them into the organizations that would be responsible for implementing them.
Yes.
When they saw them as threatening.
Yes.
To what they had at that time.
Yes.
That's when we ran into the problems, and when we went in with them and said, "Look, this is a possibility. Let's work together to develop this and implement this the way it makes sense." It was received in a much different vein, and those programs are continuing today. And I believe that this
what would be some examples, Greg?
Power systems with no moving parts, for example, simply tuned to the pulse of the earth. And I'm sure you've had guests on your show
I've heard a lot of talk, and of course they have meetings where they display these things and so forth and so on, but I have yet to see the first practical application. Have you seen it? In other words, can I go out and buy one of these machines today?
I don't know if you can buy them in the States. They're being developed overseas.
Where?
For 12-volt power systems for agricultural pumps, for example, in third world countries. Power systems in homes that...
Are you talking about free energy devices? Or over unity devices?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about the two, and that's going to lead us into a whole new conversation. But what I'll say is they're much more widely accepted. They're being developed now as alternatives. They're working them into heavily industrialized third world countries where they can't bring power lines. They're not going to burn kerosene at a gallon a minute. And for relatively light applications, and again, I'm saying 12-volt agricultural pumps, things like that. They're not powering...
12 volts from what, Greg?
12 volts from... What's the question?
The question is, what's the device?
12-volt pumps pumping water up out of the ground. I'm sorry.
Okay, the 12 volts being derived, the power source being derived from where?
There are a number of technologies. Some of them are simply tuned to the Earth. Some of them are tuned to the atmospheric Earth potential.
Okay, I know. You're talking about Tesla stuff.
Well, some of it's Tesla technology. Keeley, John Keeley, was right around the same time. Reich, Reif, all these researchers were all working around the same time.
I know of no technology of the type that you just talked about that's actually being used. A power derived from the Earth or from the atmosphere that generates 12 volts or 1 volt for that matter.
The problem with the voltage is easy. It's the amperage that's the challenge, and that's where the Tesla coils and things like that.
But even the voltage, Greg, I know about the history of Tesla, but I have never seen one of these devices, and I have begged to see them.
Really, they've been on, where I saw them first, in Colorado Springs in 1988 at the Red Lion Hotel at a Tesla conference.
I know. I hear about these things. Give me the name of a company and the number here on the air, if you wish, where I can order one of these.
I don't have it at my fingertips, sir, Art, and I'd be happy to dig that out for you. And
that's because I don't think they exist.
You don't think they're there, huh?
No, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't know. I wish they were there, and I think they could.
Sure.
I think they could be there, Greg. That's an important difference, but they are not there now. And they may be at the conferences, and I know there's a lot of very interesting things that are presented. But give me a company name, give me a number, let me order one of these devices, go out, stuff it in the earth, put up my antenna, whatever it is I have to do, get my voltage and even limited amounts of current, and I'll be a believer.
Well, I didn't know we were going to have that conversation tonight. I don't have it right here at my fingertips, and I'd be happy to get back with you on that kind of information.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, when that kind of information is taken into an existing power structure, how it's introduced makes all the difference in the world in terms of how it's received.
Well, the fact of the matter is, Greg, looking around America and the Third World, and I've done a lot of travel in the Third World, believe me, you know what they're doing? They're burning coal, they're burning oil, they're burning fossil fuels, and I think they're going to keep doing it for another 45 years, which is about when we're going to run out.
Well, they know they can't do it that long, and that's why I don't think it'll happen for that long. But the concept that we're applying here, that's the same thing with history. If you go barging into the power structures and say, look, your history is going out the window. This is the history we're going to use from this point forward. We've just gotten nowhere. We've done that before, and we've seen that. Now, I think we have the opportunity to say, Tuzahi Huas, for example, it's a perfect example. We were just in Egypt, Art, and we saw this. The Egyptians, some of them don't care about any of this. They could care less.
Oh, I know.
Some of them are genuinely interested, and they're really frightened by what this means to Egypt, what it means to their history.
It would very much disturb Egyptian history and belief systems, and they would be a fine first example.
Certainly. So what I'm saying, what I found is that when we go and work with these people and say, look, you don't have all the information, we don't have all the information, let's work together, get all the facts, and from those facts, let's move forward and see what makes sense. That's much different than going in and saying, your story doesn't work anymore, we're going to toss it out the window, and we're going to implement this new history. When we were there, I was in Egypt in, it was December of 96, and one of the most mysterious and by some estimates, John West certainly believes it's one of the oldest sites outside of Giza, is about 90 miles west of Luxor, a little village of Abydos. And that's where we find the Seti I temple that's built on top of something even older that's called the Osirian, the Temple of Osiris, very non-Egyptian. You may have seen it when you were there this last trip.
I did not, but I know of it.
Well, when we were there, it's been off limits intermittently. It depends on the political situation, things like that. We were there in 96. There was an archaeologist who was there. There's no dates, no hieroglyphics. It's never really been dated. We know that there's another temple on top that's dated at 2800 B.C., so this one has to predate that, and there wasn't supposed to be anything happening there, certainly on that magnitude. And what the archaeologist was doing, he was saying, okay, let's look at empirical dating methods. Assuming the Nile River floods once a year, which it has throughout recorded human history, he said, let's count the number of layers of silt on top of this. And he said, even if there were times in history where the Nile flooded twice a year, we'd be off by 50%. We'd still have some idea of what we're talking about. Well, When we were there in 96, they counted, Art, 22,000 layers of Nile silt on top of this temple. So if we assume one per year, one Nile flood per year, we're talking about 22,000 years. If they're off by 50%, it's still 11,000 years. And that kind of data, the Egyptian archaeologists, they have to look at that.
I believe, Greg, that in fact there were prior high technologically achieving civilizations on Earth that may have come and gone many times. I believe that almost without question.
I believe that as well, Art, and that's precisely where the rest of our conversation tonight is going to lead to, because up until 1,700 years ago, we knew pretty much what they knew. We understood fundamental key relationships between ourselves, our world, the way that we function within our world, and when those left, when they were taken out of our text 1,700 years ago, we developed a science, a mathematics, a technology that it's the best we could do with what we had, and it's based on incomplete information. Now, even though those texts were taken from us, as we're going back into the great libraries in Lhasa and Tibet, for example, or through the Nag Hammadi Library, or the Dead Sea Scrolls, or the Gnostic traditions, or wherever in Ethiopia, the translations in Ethiopia, wherever they're coming from, they're telling us about, they're reminding us of what I think many people always felt inside. That's just what you're saying, Art, that our history predates what our texts are saying to us, and that we lived our lives much differently than we do now. The reason this is important is because I know you've had many guests on your show, and I certainly have people that come to my conferences and my seminars, and they're saying, well, Greg, what about the breakdown of the ozone layer and high-frequency ultraviolet light?
Okay, just before, we're going to get to specifics, but
sure.
Just before we delve into that, Greg, you must know of Professor Michio Kaku.
I do not. I'm not familiar with
you
that name
all right.
At all.
He is one of the nation's premier theoretical physicists.
Uh-huh.
I interviewed him, I think, 2 or 3 days ago. He has a theory that I want you to listen to.
All right.
That there are various levels of civilizations scattered throughout the galaxy, the universe, that there are type zero civilizations, that would be us, the type that burn coal and oil and use raw materials to achieve their energy needs.
Okay.
Then there would be a type one civilization, which would have harnessed the power of the planet which it lives. The kind of thing that you were talking about a little while ago.
All right.
Then there would be a type two that would harness the power of a sun. Literally the power of a sun. And then there would be higher and higher levels of civilization. And it is his view, Greg, that there are countless numbers of type zero civilizations that never make it to type one.
Precisely.
They blow themselves to smithereens, or their environment is destroyed and they destroy themselves. And the odds of making it from type zero to type one, and he thinks we're on the cusp, by the way. Right?
I agree 100%.
I know. But he said the odds of any type zero getting to be a type one are so close to zero that you wouldn't even want to hear him.
I think we're about to blow those odds right out of the water.
You're my optimist.
Well, no, I agree. I agree with what he's saying, and this is the technology we've gotten this far. We've backed down from the global destruction of a nuclear war, for example. Now, who knows what we're going to do with the biological weapons.
Okay, so that means you must know where those 100 suitcase nukes are.
Art, what I know is this. Whatever happens in our world out there,
yes,
we have to reconcile it inside of our bodies. We were left the inner technology to know how to do that. That's the piece that's being overlooked by the scenarios of solar flares, of ozone breakdowns.
Uh-huh. Oh, so many ways to kill ourselves. Actually, you mentioned the ideal one a little bit earlier, and I think you're absolutely correct. I don't think that our peril will end up being nuclear dust, radioactive dust. I think that more likely the little things will get us, and we are actively, whether you people want to believe it or not, with Black Ops, creating the nastiest, meanest killing machines that you can't even see, biological killing machines, and all it would take is one accident, and our tombstone goes up for a type zero.
Art, this is the crux on the Dateline program. I think it was this is Friday night.
Right.
It was Wednesday evening.
Yes, sir.
They had a Soviet defector who was in charge of biological weapons production and
yes.
Defected to the U.S.
That's right.
He said there were to inoculate. The interviewer asked the question, "Can't we inoculate ourselves against these?" He said, "To do that, you would have to inoculate yourself, our entire Western global civilization, against at least 52 viruses and bacteria." And he said no one right now can survive 52 immunizations. This is the crux of the whole conversation that we're having here.
Yep.
We can externally try to fix all of those all of those biological entities, or, and this is the part that's being missed, I'm going to say this again and again, or we shift internally, moving ourselves out of resonance, out of the range of where those things are meaningful to our bodies, and that's precisely what we're seeing happening.
Well, it's a race.
Because, and my question is, and this is where we're going to go for the rest of the evening, is there a new race, a new species, rather, of human that's being birthed among us right now? And I believe the answer is yes. I believe that because if we define ourselves genetically the way that we always have, something has happened since 1995 to human DNA, documented in the open literature. It's not being well publicized, and that something, that change, is what it is that sets us apart from those inordinate statistics that say we'll never make it.
Many call them the millennium children.
It's happening within our generation, Art, and that is, it's called spontaneous genetic mutation in the open literature, and this is the mystery to modern science. We've seen genetic changes happen at the beginning of a new generation in response to something in the old generation.
Now, you're making a pretty wild statement. You're saying that we are presently undergoing a genetic change.
It's backed up. It's well
Greg,
documented.
can you prove that?
I certainly can, Art. I've pulled together a few notes. I've documented in a new book, and it's widely publicized in the open literature. It's not getting the attention because researchers are viewing the changes in as discrete, non-related, independent anomalies.
All right, Greg, listen, we're at the bottom of the hour.
Sure.
Pull out your notes. Because
I've got them right here.
All right, when we come back, we'll discuss the specifics of what genetic change has been documented. It's going to be an interesting point-counterpoint kind of night. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. It really is fun interviewing such an optimist, and oh, he is. He's Greg Braden, and he's a scientist, he's an author. He wrote Awakening to Zero Point and Walking Between the Worlds, and here he is once again. Greg, welcome back. Subject DNA.
A pleasure to be back, Art. And I just have to say, my optimism isn't simply blind optimism. It's based on some leading-edge research. Some of it's less than a year old, and a very different view of ancient texts and ancient traditions.
Sure.
What I'd like to say, Art, it's 3:30 here on the East Coast.
Yes, sir.
Some people may be coming on or dropping off. Could I give out a couple of 800 numbers for those people?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Your books, for example?
Sure. Well, a lot of people are asking. We have a free newsletter that talks about many of these things. It gives schedules of our talks around the country.
You have a free newsletter?
It's been free for 12 years now. 1-800-637.
Wait a minute. 1-800-637-5222.
And for book tapes and videos,
right?
800-243-1438.
243-1438.
Yes.
That's for books and videos.
Yes.
And you have a free newsletter.
Free newsletter, and there's an article in the current one discussing this very topic. Are we ready to embrace a new view of our history? And it's a pretty fascinating article. I think a lot of people might be interested in seeing that.
Oh, I should say so. So again, folks, let me help you out. I know people ran for paper and pencil and stuff. Free newsletter. Free. 1-800-637-5222, and I bet it's already busy. Books and tapes, including Awakening to Zero Point. That's a very popular book. How many books have you sold?
You know, it's interesting, Art. We've done very little advertising. We've got about 60,000 in print right now.
I believe that.
Worldwide. They're showing up all over the world.
All right. Books and tapes. 1-800-243-1438. All right. Now, you made an incredible statement. You said that there is evidence that human DNA is changing.
Yes.
So what is the evidence?
This is the crux of our whole conversation tonight, Art, and I'm going to back up two sentences. I'm going to give a context to this, and we're going to move forward with a tremendous amount of information here.
All right.
Almost universally, ancient traditions suggest that something unique is happening to Earth. You've certainly documented that in your book. I've done it in mine. And to the human body, to our bodies at this time in history, and that is the portion I believe that so many people are overlooking when we're looking at this outrageous phenomenon and falling magnetics and solar flares and ozone breakdowns and new diseases. We're looking at it from the perspective of our bodies being stagnant, being what we've always seen and believed them to be. And through the ancient traditions, the Mayan traditions, indigenous traditions, and now our own science is bearing witness to an amazing phenomenon. And I'm a little surprised it's not making front page news in popular journals, although it is in technical journals.
All right, well, I sure agree with you regarding what's going on. The solar storms, the extremes of weather. I believe our weather to be changing.
Right.
The ozone layer deterioration. I know all about that. That's well documented from space, in fact.
Uh-huh.
And on and on and on and on. So, yeah, the world is changing. But what you're telling us is we're changing with it and that our DNA is changing. What evidence of that do you have?
Well, in 1953, we discovered what we call our human genetic code, and we discovered 62 possible codes that allow what we call carbon-based life. All right? And anyone who's in life sciences remembers when they studied that, and it's still being taught in school today, one of the great mysteries of our human genetic code is why so much of our code appears to be unused.
Right, that's true.
Statistics range about 30% are used, about 60% are unused.
I think that's right, yeah.
We've believed that they were simply vestiges of something maybe from our past and really not well understood.
Yeah.
Well, what researchers are documenting now, I'll lay out the generalities, we'll go into specifics,
okay,
is that those codes that we believed were possibly vestiges of something we no longer need appear, at least in some documented cases, to be dormant codes that may be awakened by choices that we make in terms of our response to the challenges of life. Maybe the magnetics of Earth declining are a challenge, or the breakdown of the ozone and high-frequency ultraviolet light. And this is, it's relatively recently we've really begun to embrace the possibility that maybe we have a variable genetic code rather than a fixed code, and that variable code is what assures that we beat those odds that you just gave a little while ago of whether or not we survive this time in history and we survive these great changes.
Back to the best of Art Bell.
I would accept the premise that that there's a great deal of unused DNA.
Sure.
I accept the premise that we may change and adapt to what our planet is becoming. I can accept all of that, but what I would ask is, what scientific evidence do you have of actual genetic change?
We'll go back. I'm going to go back to 1995 because this is when, and 95 is relatively recent, and then we'll bring it up to even more current.
Okay.
1995 is I think, when I first began seeing the inklings of this published, and I was scouring the tech journals. And I'll just say right off, I'm not a geneticist, although I've had to learn a lot about chemistry and genetics to stay on top of this research. 1995, for the first time, to my knowledge, Art, there was a global blood study that was done that crossed geographic, age-defined, cultural, ethnic backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And the impetus for this blood study was the HIV virus. Researchers were trying to determine really where this epidemic was going. So I think that was the driver.
Right.
What they discovered surprised the researchers at... it was published in lay journals. Actually, the study was carried out by the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center, New York City.
Okay.
It was published in the Science Journal, Science News, Science Magazine, Nature, things like that. What they discovered was that at least 1%, now that's not a large percentage, and it means that it happened, at least 1% of our global population that was tested had DNA that had mutated to the point where it was highly resistant to the HIV virus.
Okay.
They wouldn't use the word immune, although the resistance was measured up to 3,000 times the resistance of the average human against the HIV virus.
All right, now may I stop you and respond?
Sure.
I am very well aware that there are, for example, in Africa, there are prostitutes that are virtually immune to the AIDS virus. They have proven this.
Right.
But I've seen no writings suggesting that this immunity was acquired through a mutated genetic structure. Where is that? How can we know that it's actually mutated in the time we've been watching, or even a generation or two, versus just the fact that we've got some people with a slightly different genetic structure in just the right place?
Art, I couldn't have done it better. Your question is leading us right to where we're going. That's why this study is different.
Okay.
Because in this study, they noted two things. First of all, they noted how unusual it is for this to happen within the same generation where the challenge, in this case, the HIV virus, has been the problem. In other words, they would expect to see it maybe in the offspring of these people. What they noted in this study, and there was a researcher named Nathaniel Landau who backed this up, and then there was further research done at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and I'll get into that in just a minute. They said that this is an example of what they were calling spontaneous genetic mutation. It was of recent evolutionary origin, and that's a direct quote from them. It appeared to have happened within the lifetime of the individual rather than at birth, in response to something that was introduced into their lives. The study at University of Alabama, Birmingham, actually has documented now 5 gene sets that appear to be dormant in some people and turned on during the lifetime of others in response. And again, this is for HIV. They're looking at the HIV virus.
No, that's fine.
In response to the challenge of the HIV virus, they've actually determined which at least 5 gene sets that are enabled, that have been disabled prior to that. Now,
all right, so that would mean that they have 2 genetic studies of the subjects that you're talking about, one showing a certain genetic structure or a certain a set of gene sets, and a second study later showing the revised or changed or activated gene sets, depending on how you want to put it. Is that what they have?
Well, those were the 2 initial studies. The second one was done in, they were both done in 1996, and they were released right around August of 96. This is important because it led to a myriad of additional studies, and these led into other areas that were not HIV-related. Some of them were cancer-related,
right.
It goes on and on. What they're finding, Art, is that in human DNA, in a DNA map, we have what are called URF, unused reading frames, and that's simply, it's a technical term, it means there's a portion of human DNA that appears to be unused.
Right.
Those portions, those of URFs, is where these new kinds of DNA are appearing from, and it's happening so frequently now. There's actually a publication called Cytokine, C-Y-T-O-K-I-N-E. And like you, and when I first began to hear this, I thought, okay, it happened once or twice. How much is this really happening? And a publication called Cytokine is documenting, it's maybe about a half inch thick every month, every 30 days it comes out, new amino acids that we've never seen before in human population studies. And these new amino acids are allowing tremendously enhanced immune systems. They're allowing cellular regeneration faster than we've ever documented in these kinds of populations before. And it all appears to be related to the outlook that these people have on the conditions of their lives. So what they're finding is that, indeed, there's something happening to... You know, 10, 15 years ago, we were told that anyone that tested positive for HIV would probably succumb to full-blown AIDS within 10 to 14 years.
Right.
That no longer is true, and I believe, and maybe this is the optimist in me again, I believe that that we will never, as a global population, succumb to AIDS because there's a part of us, collectively, we've chosen to enable that portion of ourselves to enable... physiologically or biologically, the conditions that render us, if not immune, at least highly resistant to AIDS.
Okay, Greg. All right, let me stop you there.
Okay.
We are now giving to AIDS-infected people a soup made up of AZT and protease inhibitors and other things, one other thing I can't recall. And I am told by most scientists that Particularly these protease inhibitors, in conjunction with the other drugs they already have, are actually able to eradicate the HIV virus to the degree that they can no longer measure it in the body. It doesn't mean it isn't latent, but they can no longer measure it.
Right.
And that is these, I think, conventional wisdom, scientific reason, that we are not having as many deaths of AIDS. In fact, I think it's now down for the second year in a row, but that would be the amount of time that we've been using these new treatments. What you're suggesting is that we are becoming naturally immune or building our immunity to AIDS, and that's why we're seeing fewer cases.
The globally, AIDS deaths from AIDS that are recorded anyway are down. Last year they were down 13% in 1997. I don't know where they are first 2 months of 98. We're just getting into this research, Art, because now the question that these researchers were asking and where this research has led has some pretty astounding implications that tie right back into the ancient texts, right back into what happened 1,700 years ago, into a way of approaching life or a code of conduct, if you will, that allows our bodies the fullest expression of these genetic codes and our truest nature. Our truest nature.
Would you suggest that without this cocktail they're giving to HIV-infected people, we would be having now the same remission patterns, the same lowering of the number of new cases because of genetic change?
I believe that because of the relatively few number of people that are taking the cocktail and because of the global decrease, number one, and number two, because in UCLA in 1996, and this was also reported in the New England Journal of Medicine, there were children that were born HIV positive.
And went negative.
And they didn't only go negative, it disappeared from their bodies.
That is a fact.
They were not doing the cocktails, and some of them happened within months, and the first one, the child was measured at birth at 19 and 30 days.
Spontaneous remission, but remember, this is an infant with an incredible immune system.
Precisely, which goes back to the question of what's different between their immune system and ours, number one. And the second thing to bring up, and I know we're going to break here.
No, we're okay. I want to hit you with one thing, then you can continue. What about Bangkok? What about Thailand? I'm aware the statistics there are that about 8 out of 10 prostitutes are HIV positive.
Right.
And it's because they don't practice safe sex.
Right.
It's because of needle transfer. It's because of it. So why would that be?
Okay, Art, now this is where the controversy comes in, and this is where the science comes in, because the key in, it appears, and I'll get into the research, if not before, after the top of the hour, so
sure,
people come back. The key in whether or not these dormant codes are enabled, whether or not, what's the switch that turns off and turns on these key genetic sequences, it appears to be a lost technology, a lost science that we call emotion married with logic. In other words, our belief systems, how we feel, mm-hmm. how we respond, our outlook, our view of life, and now carried into the cancers and other debilitating conditions, these are being proven out. Now, just before we go to the top of the hour, I want to share one of the studies that was done, and I don't know why these studies don't make Time Magazine. I really don't. This was Stanford University, 1996, a gentleman named William Tiller, who is really well known in his field of researching the relationship between emotion and the immune system. The way he laid this out in this particular study was that he looked at the human body as a series of biological oscillators and equated them with electronic oscillators that we're used to dealing with in our laboratories.
Right.
And what he found was that the oscillators of the human body can be synchronized through mental and emotional self-control, through our outlook on life. And in doing that, they documented direct correlations to HRV, heart rate variability. There's a study I'll share with you after the break.
Oh, we know that yogis, for example, can actually cause their heart to begin to actually can stop it.
But these aren't yogis. What they're finding, and they've taken this even a
step... No, but with the yogis, it has been so well documented.
Well, sure. And the point is, we're not all yogis. And we all have emotion, and emotion has been so overlooked in the Western world. For the first time, Art, and I've witnessed, documented, we show this in our seminars, and I've been part of the research, we've actually documented emotion as a physical waveform, and that waveform, we've actually documented now, I've seen documented, how that waveform either turns off or turns on key genetic sequences on DNA, and that is a technology. And that's the technology, I believe, one of four key technologies that was lost 1,700 years ago.
Wouldn't you agree, though, that if they had actually documented genetic change, that it would be front page news in lay newspapers,
less
medical?
No, and I'll tell you why, Art, because the implications are not well understood.
All right, listen, the clock is not our friend at the moment. We've got a break, and we will pick up exactly on the other side of the newscast, all right?
Okay.
All right, Greg Braden is my guest. What do you think, folks? Are we, in effect, mutating for what's coming? Might be. We'll be right back.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
I promise we will soon go to the phones with Greg Braden, because I think we have the essence almost out. Just a little more to do. I want to read a supportive facts for you, Greg. It says, Dear Greg and Art, I am coming to believe that my two-year-old son is a good example of the adaptation you are alluding to. And indeed, the more time we spend with him, the more I sense he is somehow, in a subtle way, bringing us along with him. The kinds of sensitivities he demonstrates to sounds and lights and other life forms around him seem to gently prod us into noticing the same things. And his rhythms with regard to activity and rest cycles are seemingly infectious, though there is obviously much peril ahead, no doubt. I think the subconscious decision we have made to go on into the future has created the window through which we are now passing. You would agree?
I would agree. I'm seeing that on many different levels, Art. And, you know, again, context is so important. If we were to witness these phenomenon without context, it's just a bizarre phenomenon. It's just isolated instances. If we were to witness unprecedented solar flares or all the phenomenon, the, you know, decrease in magnetics and breakdown of the ozone, all the new diseases, everything we're talking about, they're interesting. Researchers view them as discrete, non-related events that just happen to be occurring at the same time, and that's a perspective. And
you see them all in a larger context.
Yes, there's another perspective that says, look at this time in history, and what gives us that context, Art, is the continuity of the ancient traditions that apparently were so clear of what we were about to move into now, apparently because we have done this before to varying degrees, and this ties back into our earlier conversation. They said, sure, your Earth is going to change, and you're going to see that. Your body will change, and they left us what I believe, as a scientist and a researcher, I say this in all sincerity, they left us a technology that allows us to transcend these great changes and carry forward fully enabled, fully empowered, perhaps more than we have ever been as humans in recorded human history.
All right,
exciting. That's exciting.
It is exciting. It's true. One of your main, I think, proof points is you claim new patterns of human DNA triggering spontaneous healings of incurable conditions. Now, let's leave AIDS alone because we're going to end up probably arguing about soups and so forth and so on. Can we, in any way, scientifically, document per capita more spontaneous healings, whether we're talking about cancer or whatever, today than 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago? I mean, I could quote you some pretty worrisome stats. For example, with regard to men in America, since the end of World War II, there is a 300% increase in non-smoking related cancer. So I'm wondering, with regard to spontaneous remission, can we in any way document an increase per capita in the last 50 or even 100 years?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. Art, I think the studies, researchers are just now seeing a reason to even carry out these studies, and that's why they're so new, 1995, 96. I believe that we've always had that capability, and the second part of your question, the answer to that, is where we're going with this. You said, well, what's the difference between prostitutes in Africa that seem to be, HIV cases on the rise, and where we're seeing in other places, and that was where just at the top of the hour I tied back into the studies that were showing that the belief systems, which is a really nebulous area to get into, the belief systems of the individuals appear to be linked to their ability to enable these codes. And I say that it appears to be nebulous until 1995 and 96, when we began seeing studies come out of Stanford University, the Institute of Heart Math, for example, in Northern California, Stanford University, around in that area, that we're actually viewing our bodies as biological oscillators and showing how our choice in thought, feeling, and emotion either tune or detune those oscillators in our bodies. And they even carried that into a study, 1995, a really interesting study that was published in the Journal of Advancement in Medicine. As the first study that I saw, and there may be others out there, 1995, is the first one that I saw that actually linked emotion with our immune system. And what they did on this study, there's an antibody.
Oh, I believe it. The mind-body connection, I think, we don't need to have any disagreement about it. I mean, look, your attitude about living or conquering a cancer or whatever it is that you're facing is critical. Most irregular physicians these days have come to recognize that the importance of that. There's no question about it.
But for the first time, Art, I believe we understand why that is. Because if I had a chalkboard, I could show you really, really well. So we use the chalkboard of our mind. And what I'll say is, if we envision the double helix of DNA,
uh-huh.
And along that double helix, the great mysteries have always been, number one, how do these codes, or these, if you want to think of them as little antenna, because that's essentially the role they play in our bodies, how do they know where to form along that double helix, number one, and number two, once they're formed, how do they know whether to be turned on or turned off? How do they know whether to function or not? That's been a great mystery.
And really still is. I understand, though, your theory. You're suggesting that if the mind is properly oriented, that the mind actually will begin to use portions of the DNA code that the rest of us are not using, achieving what seems to be this miracle.
This was the belief before, Art, and this is what's different. It goes beyond the mind. The mind by itself can't do it. It must be tempered with the power that we have inherent in our bodies that we call emotion. Emotion is the waveform. Emotion provides the template that determines whether those genetic triggers are turned off or on. So the people that are doing this, the difference between the prostitutes in Africa and the people somewhere else who are turning this on, it's how they perceive, how they view their belief systems, how they view life. And we now know that thought, feeling, and emotion, and maybe you've had researchers on your program who have also spoken of this, for every emotion in our bodies, we have a chemical equivalent.
Sure.
We change pH in our brain. We change ion potential across the cell walls.
Absolutely.
That's a technology. Because as we choose very specific kinds of thoughts and emotions, we're choosing the chemistry of our bodies. That is where we tie back into the ancient traditions. Because I believe in the only word they knew 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 years ago, or even older, they left us the codes, literally the equations of logic and emotion that would allow us to enable these genetic links in our bodies and successfully carry us through this time in human history, this pivotal point in human history.
Let's take another specific to talk about for a second.
All right. Well, Art, before we do that, you asked a question. I want to make sure we have completion on these.
All right.
The top of the hour, you said, if this is happening, why aren't we seeing it in the front page news?
I did ask that, yes.
Well, a couple things. There was, I'm going to give another example of how this works. 1995, there was a study that came out. It was published in the tech journals, and you had to really dig to find it. And I still haven't seen it in front page news, and I'm really surprised about this. It was, now that we have genetic testing developed to such a sophisticated science, there was a group of researchers, they took human bone marrow, they compared it genetically to the bone marrow of Neanderthal, Australopithecus,
that's correct,
and Cro-Magnon.
Yes.
To find out, to them, in their mind anyway, once and for all, how tied we really are. Did we really descend from these earlier creatures?
I think the answer was we did not.
Well, that's precisely what the study said. There was not enough genetic evidence. There was not even a close enough match to suggest we were really even related
right.
to them. Now, why didn't that make front page news? I mean,
maybe not front page, but I was very much aware of that story. Linda Howe had a long report on my program.
We didn't see it in Time Magazine or Newsweek.
You're right.
And things like that. Because it was viewed as an independent, discrete, non-related study, and that's the way these things are coming out.
Okay, but non-related to modern man. Now, what I really asked you, Greg,
sure.
was with respect to modern man,
yes.
have we actually documented genetic change?
Yes. The answer
within...
is yes. Art, if we define ourselves genetically, the way we have since we discovered the genetic code in 1953. So if we say a human, just looking at blood, if we say a human looks like these kinds of amino acids, this kind of DNA, and you took the blood from one of these people who's undergone these changes, they don't look like that anymore. It is literally, and scientists are calling this, it's a new species of human. Can you
tell me specifically at all where they have noted these changes?
Where you mean, what part of the world?
In the genetic, in the genetic code itself. In other words, usually scientists will talk about chromosome numbers, and they'll talk about specific genes and so on and so on.
Well, what I can say to some degree, certainly, what I can say is in people who, in the global blood study, for example, the ones, individuals that showed this 3,000 times resistance to the HIV virus, what they know, the common link between all of them is they had genes that were called B27, B57, B18, B51, A32, and A25 turned on.
Yes, sir.
That are normally not enabled in regular, in the
okay, conceding that.
Control samples.
Conceding that, were they able to document that those turned on in that person's lifetime?
Yes. Yes, and that's
a giant story.
That's the key. The key is, and this was actually the quote, they say these appear to be of recent evolutionary origin within the last 5 years, Art, and that's the key, because we're used to seeing things happen with the birth of a new generation in response to something.
Oh, I couldn't agree more.
Sure.
All right, let me just quickly turn for a second to one other specific.
All right.
Because I know that you've got some words to say about this, and that is the breakdown of the ozone layer.
Oh, yeah.
And the increased ultraviolet radiation. I mean, children in Australia are now having to wear hats.
Uh-huh.
We are told that there is, I forget now, 5 to 7% drop across North America. There will be, the scientists tell us, X number of cases of glaucoma, an increase in glaucoma, skin cancer, melanoma, that sort of thing. And that would appear to be, for now at least, coming true. What do you know about all of this?
This is, Art, this is a really good example of what this kind of information means. When we first began finding about the ozone breakdown in Antarctica, where it was first noted,
right,
we were told that that high-frequency ultraviolet light was a bad light. It was harmful.
Right.
NASA sent a team down in 95, and this was documented, actually, in the Lay magazines. Time magazine did a huge write-up on this. In 95, they went down to document the die-off of single-celled organisms at the base of the food chain, because they believed it would have implications all the way up the food chain into the fishing industries and things,
yes,
like that.
Yes, indeed.
What they discovered amazed the researchers to the point where they actually released the studies a month early, because they were asking other people to look into this. They found that the single-celled organisms did not die off at all. On the contrary, they thrived in this whole high-frequency ultraviolet light, number one. Number two, they found that these frequencies that are coming to Earth through the ozone breakdown in Antarctica are the same frequencies that we generate artificially in the laboratories to cure AIDS and cancers, which I think is just amazing.
What? Wait a minute. I'm not aware of any frequencies we generate in labs to cure AIDS.
Well, I'm sure you've had guests on that have talked about ultraviolet light therapies and things like that for skin conditions, cancers. It's been applied to AIDS along with other therapies. But I mean, the light therapy.
I know that they have done testing with running people's blood through ultraviolet irradiation and different things, but I'm not aware that they have declared any great success rate.
Well, and as you're probably aware, Art, in this country, it's not a recommended course of action.
Right.
As I don't want to really get into the whole thing about Rife and Reich and.
I think you can go to Switzerland and have something like that. Sure.
You go to Mexico. Go down to Mexico and have it done. The point is, what was really interesting, and there are some people that don't do well in these lights, and there are certainly some animals that don't do well, and this is one of those instances where I don't think there's an absolute. It's how the organism responds to the light. Some people respond very well, some don't. in light of the new research, their belief systems about that light play a key role in how well they either embrace or their bodies reject that light.
So you're suggesting that if a person, for example, believes that ultraviolet radiation or even increased amounts of ultraviolet radiation will boost their immune system, will possibly help them escape an otherwise fatal disease of some sort, that those genetic changes that you're talking about will occur in that unused genetic material, and by God, it'll happen. That's what you're saying, right?
Art, it's more than belief, and I'm going to be really clear. I'm not suggesting that people go to the equator at high noon and lay naked on the beach.
I understand.
And I have to be really clear about that. Again, 1,700 years ago, these traditions that we knew before this time reminded us of our relationship with our world and with one another, and they left us the keys, the codes, to embrace the elements of nature.
All right, hold it.
And I think that's key.
Hold it right there. When we come back, we'll open the phone lines. This should be very interesting because it has been a very interesting conversation. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
There's a Carlo ghost, left sweet pride. Her hands are never cold. She's got Betty Davis eyes. She'll turn the music on you. You won't have to think twice.
Greg Braden is my guest. He's indeed a very exciting guest, and there are going to be many comments. And you're about to get to make them because we're going to open the phone lines. Just one very quick thing. Greg?
Yes.
I may have asked you the last time you were on the program, because I think the same thing came up. Have you yet had the opportunity to find a book called The Miracle Strain by Michael Cordy?
I have not. I'm not familiar with
it. I would like to heartily recommend it to you.
The Miracle Strain?
The Miracle Strain. It's a genetic thriller by Michael Cordy, and the basis of it is, and here's why you, it's fiction, all right? It's fiction. But the basis of it is that a scientist's daughter, he finds through genetic testing, is about to come down with this fatal disease. So he begins scouring the world and comes up with a computer to look, you know, at this point they've unraveled the human genome.
Right.
And he begins to look at people who have had spontaneous remissions. And he looks at their DNA and begins to notice there is a specific difference in the DNA of people who have had spontaneous remissions, hence the name, The Miracle Strain. And I won't go any farther with it, because if I do, it'll give away the book, and then it wouldn't be as much fun to read. But it's so right down the alley of what you're talking about.
You know, Art, there's such a fine line between science fiction and, what truly unfolds in our lives.
Oh, I know.
And, what's so exciting about this for me is there have been many books and certainly workshops and lectures where people say, you know, through channeled material or one way or another, that human DNA is changing. We've all heard that. For me, this is the first time, beginning in 1995, I've ever actually seen this evidence documented. And now, as researchers are viewing the possibilities of a variable genetic code, it's like wildfire. The research that is going on now, for example, why is it that humans don't produce vitamin C in their bodies? And 99% of other mammals, humans, apes, bats, and guinea pigs are the only mammals that do not produce vitamin C, because we're lacking an enzyme in our liver to convert the mineral ascorbates into the C. Everything is there, it's just not turned on. Now, in the open literature, women are documented, and these are pregnant women, that are producing small amounts of vitamin C. They're not multi-gram doses. The point is, if it can be done once, then that means that maybe we all can do it. And that's what the researchers are seeing. When a young child transmutes HIV, if he's done it, then maybe everyone can do it. Or if 1% of the human population are turning these codes on, maybe we all can do it. Someone has to do it once. And that, to me, that's very exciting. And I, within the context of this time in history, I see something very powerful happening in our lives.
And now, back to the best of Art Bell.
All right, to the phones we go, and let's see what we get. A good morning on the first-time caller line. You are on the air with Greg Braden.
Yeah, this is Thomas.
Thomas, you're going to have to yell at us.
Thomas from Oklahoma.
That's much better.
Hi, yeah, Thomas. Well, first of all, Art, you're doing a great service to mankind.
Thank you.
And I want to ask a question. Do you think that the DNA, the double helix, has got patterns as well as spiritual and all life itself?
In other words, is our spiritual self also going to be discovered to be contained within the structure of our DNA?
Okay, and that's a question for me.
You bet, not me.
Okay, well, Thomas, what I believe we're seeing, our history in the last 1,700 years, I'm going to keep going back to this, 1,700 years ago, we began to separate our spiritual outlook of life from everything else in life, and prior to that time, we did not. What I believe we're seeing now is a breakdown of the boundaries between what we consider to be spiritual and non-spiritual. The answer is yes. Science is being forced to define now actually what consciousness is, because it's consciousness within the cell that's allowing these changes to come about. So in a nutshell, that's what I believe is happening. We can certainly expand on that, but I certainly see that happening. When we go back into the ancient texts, the Egyptian traditions, the Mayan traditions, Native American, or the ancient Essenes, it's their spiritual understanding of honoring life within our bodies and honoring our relationship with the earth that brings about these changes.
All right,
I believe that's where we're all moving right now.
Of facts. Art, your guest suggests that our DNA can possibly reconfigure itself.
Ah, precisely.
Will this only benefit the next generation of humans, or will this be of any benefit to us in our lifetime? Can we, in effect, stimulate the DNA to produce a resistance to, for example, biological weapons or even the common cold?
Art, this is the key. There's actually an article in the San Jose Mercury News of a 12-year-old boy, and this is the researcher's own words, that reprogrammed his own DNA to change his broken DNA that was giving him a rare blood disorder they didn't know what to do with. He changed that, and they said he reprogrammed it on the fly from within. It's like an operating system on a computer repairing its own application programs. I believe the answer is yes, and this is why when I heard Dateline Wednesday night, and they were talking about all of these chemical and biological possibilities and how we could never inoculate ourselves against each one of them individually. And what I believe, I don't think this is an excuse, and I'm certainly not justifying what's happening. I believe we have the capability within us to turn these codes on and render that kind of warfare, render it useless.
Because
whatever is happening in our world out there, we have to reconcile it within our bodies in here. That's what the ancient traditions were so focused on, a code of conduct. They called it compassion. And it's interesting how compassion now is being viewed as a vibratory technology that allows us to program the chemicals in our bodies to give us life.
Okay.
And that's exciting for me.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. I wanted to tell Greg I did have a spontaneous healing with an ovarian tumor, but before I say that, I would like to concur with you about the reaction of that 20% of people if, for instance, the Hall of Records was opened up and all of this knowledge came forth. My husband and I became involved 25 years ago with a Christian group, because my husband's family has 8 pastors in it, and we got into it, and I want you to know that one of the first things they did when they came into our home, our pastor, he took books and burned them in our fireplace. He took art sculptures, Eskimo, beautiful art sculptures that my husband had collected. We had to throw them away because they were satanic.
What religion was this?
Christianity.
A fundamentalist Christian,
mm-hmm.
All right.
And the point, I think, that you have not gotten across to Hoagland and the rest is that it is not so much the creation part of it, but it is the fact of Jesus coming to earth and being the only salvation. You know, that when that part of it comes in, and anything that you attempt to read, if you're seeking truth, which we were, that doesn't run in that vein, and I mean, book burning, what a terrible thing. And when I look back on it and think that we allowed them to do this, it scares me to death, because my husband and I are voracious readers, and then we're listening to your program, so obviously, you know where we are in our heads. But
who are we speaking to? What's your name?
My whole name? My last name?
No, just give us your
name.
First name.
Nancy.
Nancy?
Yes.
Nancy, what I'd like to say, I've had people speak to me about the same thing, and what first of all, I'll say that I would never choose to convince or persuade anyone of anything, because that's not what this is all about. We're simply offering possibilities, and when we go back into those original texts pre-1700 years ago, they're very much aligned with everything that we're saying now. It's only after the distortions of 1700 years ago and then and later in the 15th century.
You know, Greg, I don't think that either Nancy nor myself are arguing with you with regard to your belief in an ancient civilization.
No,
or for that matter, a lot of the rest of the stuff that you've said. What we're saying is that we believe that a good 20% or less or more, whatever you want to assign percentage-wise, of people would not be able to begin to accept it, would regard this as from the devil.
Absolutely.
And there would be violence on a scale that you can't imagine at this time.
You know where I see that changing, Art, is for people...
Wait a sec.
Sure.
Is that correct, Nancy? Is that what you believe as well?
Yes, and I can tell you, Greg, it is not changing, and we were not in a small little cult group. This is a group that is nationwide, that has television. You know, it's a out front Christian group, and it is frightening because they even went to the point of teaching the women how to fire guns just as protection for the day when the government tries to come in and tell us that we can't be Christians and put that mark on our head. I mean, it's frightening, and thank God.
It can be. And Nancy, where I see that changing, and I have people from many beliefs and many walks of life that come to our programs, and they've said similar things to me. And what I invite them to do is to hang on to those old belief systems, because they've served them up to this point. And at the point that those belief systems no longer serve them, they've got something to fall back on. And here's what's happening. Those people often are presented with something in their lives that their belief system doesn't account for. And that's the pivotal point that will allow them to embrace something new. That's your opportunity to love, support, and compassionately allow another belief system to unfold and go through its own evolutionary process, because we all learn different ways at different rates. That's the beauty of the way that we're living our lives now.
Yeah, but the clever thing that they do on Sundays is that they take the very things that you discuss and they attribute it to Satan's big deception, and that for every wonderful miracle, Satan has a counterfeit. You have no idea.
I do have an idea, and I'll tell you a secret. Prior to 1700 years ago, Satan didn't exist in the way that it's seen today, and I'll keep going back to that. If they really want to see what's happening, go back to the original text.
Oh, Greg, neither one of us are in dispute with that.
Yeah.
You don't want to see it, though, Greg, because they make you, they will not allow you to open books.
Okay.
I said to my brother-in-law, who's a pastor, not a year ago, that I had just seen a wonderful program on the Dalai Lama, and his instant remark was, "There's a man that's going straight to hell," and I was horrified. Now, How do you deal with that mindset? Because they will not read any books about Tibetan Buddhists. They won't read about Native Americans, they think, are all Satanists.
Yeah, right.
Well, what do you do with that?
Why would you want to change their minds?
I wouldn't change their minds. I wouldn't even attempt it. But what I'm saying to you is that nothing that you could come up with or Hoagland about the Mars,
uh-huh,
nothing is going to change their minds.
I'd never try to.
Okay. Nancy, thank you very much. What she's trying to get through to you, and I guess I am too,
uh-huh,
is that while I believe that you are correct, Nancy is also correct, and so am I when I say there is this percentage, and we can argue about the percentage I just told you about my mail, you know, my bigger
sure
mail,
that could not
accept this information right now. And it's a race, Greg. It's a race to humanity opening its mind up a little bit and beginning to look at some different things. And if we win the race, then we win. But if, for example, the disclosure was made right now,
uh-huh,
we would not be left with an operating system.
Oh, Art, I'm not arguing with what you're saying. I'm saying I agree that it's probably a minority, and I believe that there is a principle that we're living called collective resonance, the 100th monkey principle. When the belief systems that have served those people no longer serve them, and it's happening right now, they look for something else. Until that time, you're not going to convince or persuade anyone of anything that they don't want to see, and it's a relatively small number of people that we're talking about.
Well,
I believe, I don't think that we'd collapse into anarchy. I just don't think it would happen that way.
You don't?
I really don't. Because, and maybe, you know, Art, it's not the same world that we lived in 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Maybe we weren't ready for it then.
Maybe we're not now.
If it's ever going to happen, I think now is the time because of the context within which the whole thing is unfolding. And I really believe it's how it's done, Art. If it's done responsibly, non-threateningly, and I think there's a way to, if we can put people on the moon and send probes to the edge of the solar system, we sure can work together to come to new understandings of our history. I firmly believe that.
All right. Greg, west of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hi.
Good morning, Greg. Hi,
good morning.
Art.
Hi.
I'm sorry, I have to agree with Art. I just don't think we're ready for this. I've been listening to Art Bell for 4 years now, and I've been conditioned to just about anything you can think of that you can dish out.
I dish out a lot.
Exactly, and I don't think I can take it.
Which part?
UFOs, aliens, whatever you want to talk about.
Let's leave all that behind. Let's, for a second, eliminate that. Let's just say that the news is that we are not by any means the first civilization to inhabit Earth, that there have been others, that they have been so far in advance technologically of ours presently, that they went to Mars and came back. And they're gone. History. And we're here now. Could you handle that?
I don't know. I really don't know. I think it would bother me considerably.
And what is your name, sir?
My name's George.
George? Perhaps the reason that it would be hard to embrace that is the very reason we're having this interview tonight. And think about the context of this interview. I'm offering the possibility that in our relatively recent history, we forgot a very powerful inner technology that empowers us beyond the fear of what we've always known in our lives. So we've forgotten that. Without that, here we are looking at rearranging our entire history and embracing the possibility of life from somewhere else. We haven't remembered this internal technology that allows us to feel safe in that knowledge. And that's why when I've had this conversation with John West or Graham Hancock or Robert Bouval, I said, you know, if we go marching into a chamber underneath the Sphinx, and it was that information was based on a technology that we haven't even remembered yet in our lives, what is that chamber going to mean to us? And I think that's what we're saying right now. Until we can find wholeness in our memory of our history, maybe these other things don't make sense to us, and it's all coming to a fruition. It's all coming to a head right now in one generation.
Well, I have to admit, I'd love to find out what's in those chambers.
I would, too. And would it make sense? Again, the ancients and the indigenous traditions say that we're living a path, right? I was going to get into this earlier. We're living a path right now where we build machines outside of our bodies that mirror what we are inside of our bodies. We build machines based on capacitance and resistance to remember that within our bodies. And they call that the first path. The second path is where we stop building the machines outside of our bodies because we don't need them anymore. We don't need them to the same extent because we've developed that from within. If we're talking about a face on Mars or a civilization under Antarctic ice or the chambers under the Sphinx, mm-hmm. and they were developed following this second path, they'd already remembered that, would we even recognize it?
All right.
Would we even recognize that if we walked in there right now? And that's what I believe this conversation is all about tonight.
All right, Greg. Do you think it more likely, and I know what your answer is going to be, do you think it more likely that we will save our own butts by modifying our own genetic structure in the manner that you have described, or with the Earth changes that are coming that we agree on, or do you think it more likely that science will pull our butts out of the fire by learning, by finally mapping the entire human genome and vectoring viruses for genetic change?
I think what I see happening, Art, is that the separation between the two is narrowing, and they're coming together to work together. And if we continue a path of external technology, that's where the demise comes from. Mm-hmm. If we continue to build machines outside of our bodies, we continue to engineer ourselves without really understanding and realizing the implications, that's where you run into that statistical...
Well, we sure are running down that road full speed.
We are, and there's something else that's happening on the flip side.
Hold that. On the flip side of the news, we'll talk about it. Stay right there. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Kingdom of Nine, across the country, around the world, and throughout the universe. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell on the CBC Radio Network.
All right, a listener has sent a very interesting fax. Greg, are you there?
I'm here, Art. Before we take that, can we give our numbers again?
You certainly may. First of all, folks, he's got a free newsletter. Have you tried the number lately, Greg?
Our phone number?
Yeah.
I have.
I bet it's busy.
Well, I haven't tried it since we've been on the phone, no. they've got extra operators and rollover lines.
Yeah, they're going to need them. All right. Anyway, the free newsletter is 1-800-637-5222. 1-800-637-5222. Now, there are two books that I know of. They would be Awakening to Zero Point and Walking Between the Worlds. And there are videotapes as well. I don't know about those. Tell me.
The most recent, Walking Between the Worlds, was actually just released January 1st. It's a four-hour, two-video cassette set. It's portions of it are airing on PBS stations throughout the country and local stations as well. And very, very well done.
So in other words, if I understand correctly, these are both books, but the second is also videotape as well.
Videotape as well.
Gotcha.
And a very well done videotape. It was just released in January of this year. And those are available at 1-800-243-1438. And Walking Between the Worlds is a book that really encompasses a lot of what we've talked about this last hour. And if people are really interested in this kind of work, I'm also doing a 3-day program in Denver Colorado March 12th through the 15th.
Okay.
And they can find out about that through the newsletter number 800-637-5222.
Okay. Are you ready for a question?
I am ready for a question. Actually, you asked me a question before the top of the hour, and I'd like to have completion on these.
I'm always doing that.
As we go on, you asked me if I believe science would be the ones to save us. And Art, what I have to say is I believe we're birthing a new science right now. Our present science is incomplete.
Okay, but my question was, the spirit of my question was, we are now mapping the human genome.
Yes.
We will be done, they now estimate, around 2002.
Okay.
The step after that is manipulation of
right.
the human genome. So my question was specifically, do you think that we will change ourselves with science and manipulation of the human genome, and that'll pull our fat out of the fire, or do you think it's more likely we will change our human genome through emotion and spiritualism in the manner that you have been?
I think both are happening. What science is determining is by them engineering it externally, they're figuring out what it takes to make those changes, and in doing that, they're making that connection with what we now call spirit and emotion. So they're, by going about it mechanically, they're figuring out the role that that emotion and waveform play in our bodies. I think we may beat them to it. I think we may have to, just because of some of the challenges that are happening in our world right now, and how rapidly the new amino acids are showing up every month, according to the cytokine bulletins. So how rapidly those things are changing in our bodies.
Okay. Are you now ready for a question?
I'm ready.
All right, here it is. Do you believe that a being, the Son of God, Jesus Christ, walked upon the earth as described?
What I believe is that several times in recorded human history, reference beings have walked among us, demonstrating the code of conduct that we may exhibit in life to turn on all these codes in our bodies.
Carefully crafted answer.
And I believe that in our recent memory, 2,000 years ago, that man was one of the most recent that showed us the great possibilities of what it truly means to be human.
Indeed so. And you referred earlier to Jesus Christ as a reference being, and that is exactly why I asked that question. Now, part two.
Oh, part two.
That's right. Perhaps you could shed some light on this. The Bible is replete with stories of Christ producing immediate miracle cures. If the Shroud of Turin could contain DNA from Jesus, what would you think that DNA would reveal as compared to modern man's DNA?
Art, there's a whole conversation I didn't even know we'd get into tonight. It's part of my research.
I like surprising people.
It's part of the program we do. I'll be doing this in Denver, Colorado. I was recently gifted a subset of the 30,000 slides that were taken during a five-year research project that began in 1978 from Los Alamos National Labs, Sandia National Labs, a multidisciplinary task force examining the Shroud of Turin. We all heard about the study that was done in 1988, 10 years later, that said the whole thing was a hoax. We didn't hear much about the five-year study that was done with aerospace technology. One of the things they discovered was that the blood on the Shroud is actually blood. The 88 study said that it was pigment and ochre. It is actually blood. The blood is human blood. Of course, we can't say exactly whose it was. The blood has been typed. They found hemoglobins. They found bile pigments. They found blood proteins. And I do not know whether or not that DNA, where that DNA analysis is right now. I would expect they would find amino acids in that blood that we're either just now seeing or have never seen before. In our current blood studies, because we're just now learning how to turn the codes on to produce that kind of DNA. And there's a
very straightforward answer.
Well, I just laid out a vast array of possibilities, and I'll tell you the images. Over 30,000 were taken in a 5-year study, and I've got 65 of those with me now, and they are pretty awesome and open up a vast array of possibilities. And what I'd like to say, Art, is I believe that this transcends. This isn't about religion. It transcends religion, science, miracles, and carries it all to a greater height of human possibility and what we have, this mystery that lives within us.
All right, back to the phones we go. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hi.
Hi, Art, this is Dan in Virginia. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Dan, how are you doing?
Great. I've just read part of the new book that's come out by a local researcher. Her name is Candace B. Pert.
I'm not familiar with that book.
You are familiar with it?
I am not. What is the title?
Molecules of Emotion.
I've heard of it. I have not read it personally.
Well, I highly recommend it because she's made the connection between, she's been able to measure the changes in the molecules through emotion.
Uh-huh.
And she's a researcher at Georgetown University, Department of Physiology and Biophysics. And she's on Bill Moyer's PBS program, Healing in the Mind.
Sure.
And also a book that he's written.
I believe she may be referencing some work by a woman named Valerie Hunt, who was one of the pioneers in this field. And again, this is modern science coming about it through the back door.
Exactly.
They're finding the relationship between thought, feeling, emotion, and they make that distinction, and DNA. And the ancient tradition said, as you embrace these kinds of thoughts, feelings, and emotions, this is what happens in your body. And now we're living this time in history where our bodies have to change. We're challenging our bodies with this tremendous global change, and we're responding to that. We're surviving by adapting and turning on these dormant codes to become our fullest potential. So I'm not surprised that book has been recommended to me, and in my copious spare time, one of these days, I'd love to sit down and read it.
All right, Dan.
Two other points, real quick. I think essentially what the fundamental baseline is, where this is going, is if you raise the vibration, the body, you raise it above the vibrational pattern of the illnesses or the diseases, and they can't bother you. And secondly, what this all is about is empowering the human being to realize that he has the potential to do these kind of things.
All right, Dan. Thank you. And you would, I take it, certainly agree with that.
I would. All right, certainly.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hi.
Good morning, Greg. Hi, Art. How you doing?
Just fine.
Good morning. This is Dan from Moline, Illinois.
Yes, sir.
I've got a question for you, or maybe just a comment, and then I've got another question, but... excuse me. I've been able to, I'm a private pilot, and I usually have a good time with the flight physicals.
Right.
I go in and they put you on a treadmill, and then you once you get off the treadmill, they check your heart rate. Well, I can take my heart rate, and I can think about it and cause it to drop, drastically drop.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I did it, and they wanted to take me to the EKG, to give me an EKG, because they thought, this is impossible. You can't do this.
Sure.
And I find that by centering myself and concentrating when I was overseas and getting shot at, your heart's beating so fast that you can't hear anything. So if you calm yourself down and slow your heart rate down, you can begin to hear again.
To calm yourself down, Dan, and you may be aware of this or maybe you're not, to do that you're having a very specific quality of thought, feeling, and emotion, whatever that means to you, producing the chemistry in your body that allows what researchers call HRV, heart rate variability, and also the electrical impulses in the heart change. And all that's done simply through merging the waveforms of thought, feeling, and emotion, and that's the technology, the inner technology that we're talking about.
I can do it anytime.
I believe you can do it. As I said, there was quite a discussion not long ago on a major news show about yogis who are able to do this. They can go beyond that. They can cause their heart to begin to
filbrate or actually stop, even stop for a period of time. So if they can do that, then I believe that that people can control bodily functions. I'm not certain that this automatically extends to control of DNA.
The DNA, right.
Turning on DNA, but I'm certainly willing to consider it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is Heather in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Hi, Heather.
Hi. Thank you, Art, for the gift of your show.
You bet.
Good morning, Greg. Thank
you. Good morning, Heather.
Good morning. Thank you. I've got a question, and quickly, I've been getting that the New Age is definitely a New Age, not a Renew Age. In the past, spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical have been at best integrated, but in this New Age, sort of a new state is happening. For lack of a better word, we can call it love or compassion, but it's neither physical nor mental nor spiritual or emotional. It's a new state of being.
All those combined?
Combined. And obviously this DNA, this conscious evolution that you're speaking of, which is the words that keep coming to my mind while I'm listening to you.
Barbara Marx Hubbard coined that word, conscious evolution, back in the late 80s.
I was in one of her resonating core groups back in the late 80s when I was 18.
Yeah, that's where that comes from.
Yeah, okay, that's why it's coming back up again. Anyway, you mentioned four technologies. Could you mention the other three?
Certainly. The 1,700 years ago, and again, I'm tying back into that for listeners that weren't with us earlier.
Thanks.
And these key elements were taken out of our traditions. One of those elements was the understanding of the uniqueness of this time in history. History points to now as being very unique, and everyone seems to know that except us in the Western world. The second one is the relationship between us and our world, that we have direct access to our world through a highly sophisticated vibratory technology that we call thought, feeling, and emotion, mm-hmm. based in prayer, which is very different than the prayer that's taught today.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, the relationship between how we view ourselves and the forces of this world, if we see them as good or bad, light and dark, and we just barely touched on that a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And number four is a very ancient science of thought, feeling, and emotion that we call compassion. And it's
yes.
interesting that compassion is receiving so much focus within these last months, because it is a quality of thought, feeling, and emotion that triggers these codes in our bodies. So, Art, we were talking, you had some callers earlier, Nancy, that called earlier, for example, and said, what about people that don't want to accept this in their lives? We can go back to these models of thought, feeling, and emotion, and if they're angry about these new ideas, then we all know what that anger is doing to their immune system,
mm-hmm.
what it's doing to cellular functions. It's been very well documented. And that's a choice they're making in their lives until it no longer works, and then they'll fall back on something else. And we simply are asked to support our loved ones, you know, as they make those choices in life.
I really, sorry?
He finished as they make those
yep.
choices in life, he
yep.
said.
I wanted to thank you for doing so much to remove a lot of the fear that's going on out there, and putting people back into control.
Thank you for recognizing that, and I appreciate that.
All right. Let's see. First time caller line, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Bell and Mr. Braden.
Where are you, sir?
I'm in, my name is Mark, and I'm in Springfield, Illinois.
Okay,
good
Mark.
Morning, Mark.
Kind of, I think you're talking about some ancient civilizations here.
Sure.
No, I'm nervous, I'm sorry. I read a few years ago in a book on strange and unusual subjects about a metal column, or like a column. It was made out of some type of a metallic alloy in a jungle somewhere.
It's in India.
In India?
And a researcher friend of mine, his name is David Hatcher Childress.
Okay.
I met with him up in Boulder, Colorado, along with Hancock and Bouval and John West and those people. And he, David Hatcher Childress, has written extensively about that column.
Cool. That was 15 years ago that I read that.
Sure. It's a metal we've never seen in this world before. It doesn't rust. It doesn't deteriorate. It's based in an alloy that doesn't seem to be anything from the technology that we have today.
Now, that is astounding.
Well, it's one of, you know, Art, we call them anomalies
when we compare them, and this is another show we could do, there's a whole thing on this, when we compare them with what we have today, they're only anomalous through the view of the paradigm we have today, and through these ancient traditions, not only are they not anomalous, you would expect to see these kinds of things. You would expect to see the miracles in people's bodies. You would expect to see this kind of technology, because it was based on honoring the relationship between us and the elements of our world, and that affords a much fuller science, a much fuller technology.
Well, I've heard a good 10 shows born that could be birthed from the one we've done this morning. Stay right there, Greg. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we'll be right back. Greg Braden is my guest. I'm Art Bell, and this, of course, is Coast to Coast AM. All right, back now to Greg Braden. And I think you will agree with this, Greg. Sent to me by Mike in Ohio. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation.
Oh, that's very interesting. You know what? What we're doing here, Artie, again, from my perspective, I never choose to convince or persuade anyone of anything. We lay out possibilities and opportunities so that we can have all the information and make our own choices. And that's why it's such a joy to be on your show. And I'll take this opportunity to thank you for being such a gracious host and allowing this forum for just these kinds of discussions.
Well, you're fun to interview.
Well, thank you.
All right, first time caller line. You're on the air with Greg Braden. Hi.
Yes, hello, Art. It's so refreshing to hear a guest such as tonight who is so positive about the future and spare me from the dames of the world who can only spread fear. And you know that emotion that emotion does to our.
Well, I'm kind of against attacking people who are not here to defend themselves.
Well, I definitely agree with everything your guest is saying tonight.
That's positive.
And certainly, it's been shown in the laboratory by many writers like Deepak Chopra, who talks about emotions release a substance called neuropeptides throughout our body, and they can either strengthen or weaken our immune system. The positive emotions like love, compassion, send positive neuropeptides to our immune system.
Oh, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. The bigger question, though, is whether we can actually modify our gene structure through those mental and emotional actions.
Well, it's good news to hear if that is the case.
Indeed, it is good news to hear.
Well, thank you for your call tonight. What I'd just like to reiterate again, you know, there's so many researchers, and I work with them every week, who are out there looking at the same things that you and I are looking at. They're seeing the changes in the earth, and they're believing the changes are simply happening to us. And all we're laying out here is the possibility that maybe we've got something to say about how we respond to those changes. They may be catapulting us into greater potentials of human expression. And we're not minimizing the changes. We're certainly witnessing and measuring them right now. But the key is now we understand we have a choice as to how we respond, at least in some of the studies and
this is an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nye.
What do you consider the odds, Greg, that on our present course, with change occurring and earth change occurring at the rate it's occurring,
right,
that we will change in time?
Art, if you'd asked me that 15 years ago, I would have said it's a race. And what I see right now is it's already happening. These changes they're already occurring. We're measuring them real time. The first book, Awakening Zero Point, you know, we talk about this time the ancients called the shift of the ages that everyone's been waiting for
from my perspective, the shift of the ages has already begun. We're living this time, the shift of the ages, and I think the odds are very good. I have this tremendous faith in the potential of our collective wisdom, and that's what I'm seeing. Sure, we're going to have little isolated pockets of individuals who cling to obsolete belief systems because they still work for them, and I certainly honor that. Everyone has the right to cling to whatever belief system until it no longer serves them.
Yes, although you are suggesting that if enough people cling to that obsolete belief system, as you call it, that we are doomed.
If that were the case, Art, and what I see is an overwhelming support. I have the opportunity to travel globally, and I can go to a little village in the Andes Mountains. We were just in Egypt in January. We'll be in Tibet in April and back in Peru and Bolivia. And I can speak to people who know nothing about the face on Mars, who don't know anything about the shift of the ages, and they say something's changed in their village, something's changed in their family, something's changed in the way they feel about life. And to me, that's exciting and that's positive. I believe that we're making the shift right now. And at evenings like this, people will listen to this and they won't agree with what's being heard. And that's great, because what happens is they say, I don't agree with this. I think this is happening. And that sets them on a course of discussion and opening to the realm of possibilities. And then you and I have done our jobs really well together.
In my case, as I have listened to you, Greg, I cannot embrace all that you say is so. But on the other hand, I absolutely don't reject it as a definite possibility.
You know what I think will happen, Art? It'll be kind of like when I was looking for Jeep Cherokees years ago. I went and looked at them a lot, and I started seeing them everywhere.
Yep.
Now that I've laid out these possibilities, I think you'll have guests on your show, and you'll say, well, you know, Greg Braden just said something about that the other night. And it'll because now all of us, we have a new context. And within that context, you'll hear information that some may support it, some may not. And I think you'll hear more and more where you'll find room for this kind of thinking and these kinds of possibilities in the paradigm that you entertain in your life. And we're all, I'll just emphasize this, we're all learning. This is new for all of us, and we're always getting updated information.
Okay, here's a whopper for you, Greg.
All right.
You believe there was at least one and possibly many civilizations that may have exceeded us technologically in the past?
Certainly, yes.
What do you think happened to them?
Well, let me back up. When you say exceeded us, and we just barely touched on this earlier.
Yes.
Ancient traditions suggest that we have embarked upon a path they call the first path, where we forgot who we were, we forgot our relationship to our world, and we build external technology to remind us of that. So we have a very complex structure in our society. I believe that at least one of these technologies that predates us chose the second path that looked much less complex. They didn't have to have all the external machinery that we do right now, and allowed them.
The question is, why aren't they still here?
Well, what I believe in the most recent case, I believe what happened was that there was a factor no one accounted for, a cataclysmic factor that wasn't accounted for. And that we are witnessing the remnants of them when we see Egypt and when we see pre-Incan technology surpassing anything we've ever seen anywhere else. We're seeing those remnants. One of the reasons I'm going to Tibet is because I believe they're living those traditions real time in some pretty out-of-the-way monasteries, and I'd like to witness that and then bring that back to the Western world through my work. Rather than just talking about texts or temple walls, how are they living these traditions today? And I think they're direct descendants from...
Well, that's a worthwhile investigation and another show to do. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Denise in California.
Yes.
Good morning, Denise.
Good morning, Greg. Art, I love your show.
Thank you.
And you've got the best guest. I had a comment and then a question for Greg. I usually get your show kind of late, and I listen on KSFO in San Francisco.
Right.
And They usually used to replay the first 3 hours at 3 a.m.
Well, they're just carrying the full live show now.
Yeah, right. And so I would just encourage the listeners in KSFO hearing to contact the station and see if we can get that changed and get you back on from 3 to 6.
You're always welcome to allow encourage people to contact their local stations and encourage them to do as you as a customer would like.
Okay. Now, my question for Greg is, it's concerning, I have a relative who's in a coma, so I've been reading tons of stuff on the brain in the last 4 months.
Sure.
And the one connection that I've read a lot about is the connection of emotion with in the hippocampus.
Yes.
And so I'd like you to make a comment on that. And then my other question is, do you believe it will be possible, if it's not now, in the near future, to regenerate neurons that will be functional?
Well, you've asked a couple of questions. The answer to the second question, I believe, is yes, and I see evidence of that happening now. First question, I'm going to back up and make a general statement in the interest of time, and what I'll say is that for every thought, feeling, and emotion, and again, there's a technology here, every thought, feeling, and emotion that we choose to have in our bodies, there's a chemical constituent to that. So whether you're talking pituitary, or thymus, or hypothymus, whatever it is that we're talking about, what we're finding is that they're not randomly regulated. It's kind of like we come into this world on autopilot until we figure out the quality of thought, feeling, and emotion, and then we take ourselves off of autopilot, and we create those chemical reactions in our bodies. That's the technology. So in terms of someone who's who's in a coma, without knowing more about what induced the coma and the condition of the person, I'm really reluctant to speak to that specifically.
All right, let us leave that for a second.
Okay.
She spoke of neurons.
Right.
What about arms and legs?
In terms of regeneration?
Uh-huh.
I've never seen arms and legs regenerated. What I've seen documented in the open literature are internal organs.
The reason that I ask this is because if we can actually modify our genetic structure,
right,
that should be possible.
I believe 100%. I've never seen it documented in the West. I've seen it suggested in the East. And in the West, what I have seen are internal organs that are supposed to be removed that essentially grow back again. And in light of the etheric template or the vibratory template that remains, I would expect to see that. We don't expect to see it, so maybe that's why we don't see it that much in the West.
You must admit that at best that's anecdotal, and that if it's possible for internal organs to be regrown or regenerated, it should be possible for external ones to be regenerated as well.
I believe that that's possible, Art. I believe it probably happens, and it's not well documented, and I have to say I've never seen it well documented in New England Journal of Medicine or the AMA.
All right. Good enough. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hello.
Good morning, Art. This is Ken in Thunder Bay calling.
Thunder Bay.
Ontario.
All right.
Good morning.
Good morning, Greg. I'm listening to you on 1110 KFAB out of Omaha.
Yes, sir.
You more or less touched on my question with your last one, but has there been any studies showing, I'm very nervous, aid in helping a physical injury? You know, you're talking a lot about diseases and viruses and whatnot, but like physical injuries,
certainly.
We literally just covered that. Now, physical injury, I suppose to a lesser degree than we just had a discussion about, yes, healing, I think he was talking about healing, right?
The answer is yes. I've seen it myself with my own eyes, so I can speak from direct experience. And I've also, in the open literature, well documented cases of healing bone very quickly. And Art, again, and I'll just invite the listeners to bear in mind, in these 4 hours, we're just barely touching the surface of information that has vast implications. What I've actually witnessed, Art, is on a TV monitor in front of me, Japanese physicians using traditional Japanese healing techniques that we're talking about right now, and watching in real time, in less than 3 minutes, a bladder cancer disappear. And
wow.
And it's right there on the video. I've seen it.
They are working with the woman who has the bladder cancer to help her through this, and they're doing it without the aid of any ultrasound or anything like that. They're simply doing it through what today some people would call hands-on. It's a magnetic therapy, magnetism running through their bodies.
Did they have her in a CAT scan or something to be able to see this occur?
They actually had her. It was on a sonogram.
Sonogram
happening real time. They had the tumor on one half the screen, on the right hand of the screen. They had the real time tumor so that you could compare the two. And once the process began, within 3 minutes, it was just amazing.
My God, that's astounding. Is that on your videotape?
It's not on mine that I have out now. We're working to get permission to incorporate it into at least into the workshops and possibly into the videos.
I can see why.
And what they were doing, they were using emotion and the magnetics of the emotion in the body, which is an area we didn't even get into. It's a technology that we call healing, and now we're just understanding what healing really means to us.
Wow. All right, I hope you get it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden and not a lot of time. Hello.
Hi, this is Rick in Seattle. How you doing, Art? Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
Yeah, great show. And like the one caller said, I really like the kind of positive way you're looking at things and helping to educate us, both of you gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah, one thing that I was thinking of earlier, and you made the point that I was going to make, Greg, when you're talking about just the fact that people are becoming more aware, it's going to slowly chip away these paradigms. And like you said, Art, that 20% of those letters you get?
Yes.
Well, just the fact they're writing a letter means that at a certain level they're aware, they're being exposed to it, so there's hope for change. And the two questions I have are basically, one for you, Greg, and that would be, we're talking a lot about kind of raising the spiritual awareness and the vibratory level, through teachings and writings, perhaps some of them that we've lost. What about the external possibility that we're going to a different area of space with a vibratory level of space itself is different and might change us?
I think the vibratory level of the Earth, actually the Schumann resonance, you believe is going up, moving up, don't you, Greg?
Well, we didn't get into that tonight. There's a lot of controversy. It's Earth vibration, which now is being measured as something different
than Schumann.
Than Schumann out of the atmosphere.
All right, we're not going to have time to get into this. We've got material here for a good dozen shows, at least.
I'd like, in response to that, what I'd like to say, and again, Rick is your name?
He's already off, because we're out of time.
What the ancient traditions say to us, Art, is that as we simply honor one another in life, honor our relationship to the world, to our Earth, we've already addressed that spiritual aspect. We've already shifted bodily frequencies, and wherever Earth is taking us and whatever is happening is already accounted for simply by living life in the presence of one another and honoring one another in life. And that's a whole technology unto itself.
All right, Greg. Now, to get a free copy of Greg's newsletter, you can call 1-800-637-5222. To get either one of his books or the available videotapes, you can call 1-800-243-1438. And, Greg, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on the program.
Well, thank you, Art. I just appreciate your gracious hospitality and your joy to bat these ideas around with. So it's been a lot of fun.
All right, my friend. Take care. Until next time.
You take good care.
All right. That's Greg Braden, folks. That's it. We are woefully out of time. I would like to say that if you would like a copy of this program, and I am getting multiple gazillions of requests for it, it is a 4-hour program, and you may get it by calling beginning now 1-800-917-4278. Let me give that number again. Please write it down. 1-800-917-4278. We'll be back with Dreamland on Sunday. And then, of course, Monday night, Tuesday morning, we are going to be discussing a very timely thing, the Titanic. Have you seen that motion picture yet? It deserves everything it's going to get. What an incredible, incredible story the Titanic is. That's what we're going to be talking about either Monday night or Tuesday morning, dependent on your time zone. For now, from the high deserts in all the Americas and across this great globe, good night.